following is not, I repeat, is not a paid advertisement. Clayton is one of the others. We here at the Next Step Radio Show have a mission to go find the others. If you would like to promote your product, idea, or event, email me. TheNextStepRadioShow@charter.net. That is TheNextStepRadioShow@charter.net. Remember, to truly be free, you have to let other people be free. If you want to change the world, you have to start by changing your world.
Did you know that 21 million people are starting food gardens this year for the first time? Nothing is more empowering to your personal sovereignty than growing your own food. You pay no tax on the time you spend growing your own food. Gardening is a gateway to self-sufficiency. If you want to grow some of your own food, by planting a seed, there's no better way to start your seeds than using the Soil Cube tool. I am Clayton Jacobs, and I make the Soil Cube tool. The Soil Cube tool makes 2-inch by 2-inch cubes of soil that produce the hardiest seedlings for your garden. Rediscover this 2,000-year-old technology used by the Aztecs. There are no pots, peat pellets, or anything else to buy to start your plants for your garden off right. Use your own garden soil as the containers to start your seeds. Watch our introduction video at SoilCube.com. Thank you, Antimatter Radio.
Welcome one, welcome all. This is the Next Step Radio Show, brought to you on the Antimatter Radio Zone Network, also simulcast at GoFindTheOthers.com. I am your host, Jacob Avelman. If you'd like to get a hold of me, the email address, TheNextStepRadioShow@charter.net. That is TheNextStepRadioShow@charter.net. You can also find me on Facebook, Jacob Appleman, JacobAppleman. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. We have a super special treat for everyone. This is episode 30 of the Next Step Radio Show. The next 6 episodes, from number 30 through 35, are all the same topic, hitting it from every angle possible. The topic is the sacred science. We had 3 special guests joining us through the course of this series of episodes, Crystal Clark, Matt Presti, and Robert Ote. Crystal Clark will be featured in episodes 30 and 31, Matt Presti and Robert Ote in episodes 32 and 33, and we'll finish off with episodes 34 and 35, rejoined by Crystal Clark. All 6 of these episodes were recorded a month ago, on May 17th and May 18th. I would really not like to feed any more energy, nor get into the particulars of the delay. And maybe in a future broadcast, I will divulge the entirety of the story between recording and posting. For now, all I will say is thank you very much to all involved. I appreciate your patience, and I apologize for the delay. And since so many of us have been waiting so long for this to be posted, so much of it will be explained as we go. This is episode 30. Up first is Crystal Clark. We will be discussing all things sacred science. Crystal Clark is an author. She has written 2 books thus far, Who Are We Really 101, Return of the Shaman, and Who Are We Really 102. If you're not hearing this on my website, head over to GoFindTheOthers.com. That is GoFindTheOthers.com. And all of the links for all of our guests will be posted with all 6 of these episodes. Before we begin, we'll have a moment of inspiration from our good friend Talam Acey and a piece of his, it's called the Gil Scott Heron Permission Poem.
What if this is God's work? Perhaps we should ask the last poets and Gil Scott Heron for permission to speak before we start. Some of my contemporaries act like we created the art when ain't none of us seen no parts of the charts for anything we write, and Gil Scott Heron done seen them twice. once for the bottle and then for Johannesburg. And we stand and serve the listeners as if the pioneers ain't up on stage with us on their shoulders, trying to hold us upright while we position ourselves as God's gift to the stage and the mic, when Lord knows they were traveling the globe long before some of us were even flecks of light in our parents' eyes. And we self-romanticize to the point that the apparent size of our ego supersedes those facts, like spoken word was just waiting for us to be born, but was still born before that. And they don't even go back to Kamal Daoud, Kalamu Yasalam, or Keith Roach. The furthest their legacy goes is their local slam culture, open mic poetry hosts. They can't be bothered to go back as far as Sekou Sundiata, then can't understand why I command such a high level of respect in this new generation of poetry. But perhaps it's because I have the sense and the reverence to study the ones that came before me. Been checking Nikki Giovanni ever since I could read. And Sonia Sanchez is like Ma Rainey, like Bessie Smith, like Big Mama Thornton, pitchforking the blues on a crossroads paved with wayward souls. These be them blues that flow deep below the floodwaters of Tupelo. And they look at me like, so, what could they possibly know about Langston Hughes being the first among us to earn a living off of his words? Especially when it's like 100 years later and they're still hotting from their boss at work, trying to create some type of cubicle masterpiece. And they can't be asked to read about how Phyllis Wheatley wanted to publish a book of pro-American poems but had to send it to Britain to do it, because to them that's just foolish. They live in an age where anyone can publish anything as long as they have access to a computer. And they feel like the only reason their name ain't ringing out yet is because the people who are listening to their work must be stupid. But could it be an over-reliance on monotonic monologue prose? Could it be a lack of originality and a failure to pay dues? Could it be the more you sleep in bus and train stations, the more you experiment with rhyme, texture, and cadence? Could it be the more you're forced to skip meals, the less you worship esoterica and begin to concern yourself with what working people consider real? To the extent you believe it's art to be perceived as incomprehensibly smart, you'll be finished with spoken word long before your dumb ass even have sense enough to ask for permission to start. So what if this is God's work? What if real poets walk the earth and live lives fit for a prophet's birth, spreading ancient wisdom like the Coptic church? And those that know what they're hearing know that they're hearing something special. And perhaps eventually a poet will be seen here just to bless you, test you in this world of lies. And if you feel your eyes cry to you because they recognize it, what they're seeing is the truth. And the chills up your spine provide absolute proof that in this now, where politicians and clergy are proving themselves unworthy of your time, and television shows and music videos are proving themselves unworthy of your mind, don't be surprised to find that God is especially present in poetry dens, guiding poets' pens, and not just those men who pretend to be closer to God than you, by making you ashamed of your sins when the lives that they've lived may not have been what God intends for your salvation. What if this is God's work? What if the creator realized that the creation isn't perfect, but only wishes for us to worship sincerely, to not be hypocrites, but to really be concerned about our fellow man, to stand up against injustices falsely perpetuated in God's name in foreign lands? What if this is God's work? What if the poets are closer to Muhammad, Buddha, and Jesus than the preachers? I said, what if the poets are closer to Muhammad, Buddha, and Jesus than the preachers? I mean, think about it, y'all. What if it's living closer to the streets? And what if it's living closer to Caesar? What if it's living high up on the hog? And what if it's the poor righteous teachers? What if this is God's work? And if so, then poetry is sacred. So you poets should be concerned. Would you step up on this stage with them? Be on your job. Because if this is God's work, then stealing from another poet is the same thing as stealing from God. And it's not about your use of sexuality or profanity. It's about whether you use your tools for ahs and oohs, or whether you use your tools to improve humanity. What if this is God's work? And no blasphemers have hell to pay, so I wouldn't say anything at Golden State tonight that I wouldn't be comfortable repeating on Judgment Day. What if this is God's work, y'all? Let us pray.
All of the stuff going on is the Armageddon script. That's what it is. And I'll talk about it in just a minute, but I want people to understand how insane this is. It's absolutely insane. The Armageddon script is something that Edgar Cayce talked about, in that he saw the future. He saw that these things would happen. And from what I understand, it's also a type of prophecy that he also saw. He's not necessarily the only person. But this script is everything that they're doing right now. Japan is part of the script. Trying to get Japan to sink into the ocean is part of the script. The earthquake on the East Coast, the big earthquake along New York, the New Madrid Fault, California, a big earthquake in California, all of these uprisings in the Middle East, all of this is part of that script, and it's all being instigated, all of it, because they're following the script. And what's really, really important for people to understand is that some people will say that evil is good. Evil is good. We need evil. Evil teaches us a lesson. I really, really, really disagree with that, because the program that we live in is created to create, regenerate, restore, and uphold life. So if we deviate from those laws, we create our own punishment. It's built into the program. But what's so bizarre and psychopathic about what they're doing with this Armageddon script is that they sell it to more and more people to help them implement it, under the idea that we're just a bunch of stupid sheep and we're reproducing too fast and on, and that we don't know any better. But in fact, it's these same people that hid it all from us so that we wouldn't know any better. That's the insanity behind it. I mean, do you see what I mean?
Right, yeah, they dumb people down and kept technology and information and certain books and libraries out of public view, and then deteriorate the food and the education. And then, how many ever decades or generations later say, look at all these stupid, unhealthy, ignorant people running around, which is a direct result to the actions taken so long ago. And then, they hate what they created or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's so bizarre. I mean, I don't even know if they realize. I guess I can't even process the kind of mindset that would do that, right? You don't teach people how to take care of themselves, their children, or their planet, and then later on just decide to get rid of all of these people because they don't know how. But you never bothered to teach them how when you knew. So, it just doesn't make any sense.
Do you think, like John Lamb Lash's take on Archons, some kind of disincarnate spirit influencing the form of thought that seems so insane? Do you think something like that's at work?
I do think that there are very sinister forces behind the scenes promising these people something that they're never actually going to get. And I think that there are two different schools of thought, but I think that right now they're playing nice in the sandbox together because they kind of have the same goals for a while. And I think that part of the Armageddon script is to get the Messiah to return, or to get the real Messiah to come for those who don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And even that in itself, there are people that honestly do believe that that's their job, is to do this, to make this happen. But even that in itself has its own insanity in it, because that's like saying, if I spent my entire life creating this big multi-billion dollar company that was perfect, and I gave it to my son and I said, here, this is for you, I want you to run this company so I can go on vacation, and then I go on vacation and he runs the whole thing into the ground just because he wants me to come back.
Right.
really, that doesn't make any sense. Especially, you're talking about the planet that you live on. It's your own children, your own grandchildren. And the way karma works, we also get reborn into the future. So it doesn't really make, the whole side of it doesn't make sense. It just doesn't. But that's where they're coming from. They believe that they need to bring the Messiah here, and that the only way to do it is to really, really mess everything up. To kind of flesh him out, if you will. And then there are people who believe that there's some dialogue in the second book about this, because I know it sounds strange, but there are people who believe that it's their job to be the evil so that we can see the contrast, and that through making us go through hell, we will see the best part of ourselves, and then we will evolve, and then they will get the credit for it. That's the other side of it. And that may sound really far out, but I can give you a couple of examples. And Ramon over at Conscious TV read this really beautiful letter from a friend of his in Japan about how nice it was after the earthquake, because people were talking to each other again and they were helping each other. And it was like the old days. If people had water, they would put up signs saying, "We have water," and there was community and camaraderie again. And yeah, that's beautiful. But what really bothered me about that is I knew the moment I heard him read that letter that the people that were behind that said, "You see, we're right. The only way to get humanity to bring the best of themselves out is to put them through hell."
Right.
But again, that's the insanity of it. They didn't teach us the other way. They didn't teach us the other way. So why are we fighting in the first place? Were we born hating each other? No, it was taught. So none of it makes any sense. But these ideas are ingrained into these people, and that's what they think. They think that, look at 9/11. Look how full the churches were after 9/11. It was a horrific thing, but they looked at that and said, "We did that. We brought these people back to God. We're the ones, by putting them through hell, that are helping them." And they think they're going to get all the credit for it, but there's a scripture that very clearly says that they won't. I guess they didn't read that part. I don't know, but that's where they're coming from. And I think that people need to be really, really careful when they say that, yeah, evil works for us, evil is good, evil teaches us a lesson, because every time we say that, these people are sitting there going, yeah, we know. That's why we've poisoned the planet. You know, that's why we killed off the Gulf of Mexico. That's why we put fluoride in the water. That's why we create all these wars. That's where they're coming from. They believe that.
When I had a good solid dose of the eugenics material, you know, under my belt, and a better take on, you know, how war started, and, you know, the new HARP technology and all of the other things associated with that, I had for a little while pondered, though I've given up on it slightly, and I see, like you were saying, an Armageddon script. But I often wondered if the ultimate tippy top of this pyramid weren't, you know, these bloodlines that have had dynasties and estates and all the greatest food and all the greatest lovers and every drug known to man, you know, had been to outer space and way underground, and they kind of, you know, they've cloned things and killed things and started wars and ended wars. And at some point, I thought, well, what would be left, you know, for them to quote-unquote experience? And this was about the time CERN was getting popular, you know, 4 or 5 years ago in the alternative community. And when you hear the whole bit about Shiva out front, you know, and their logos of 666 and all this and that, I had like a flash of possibility enter my mind that maybe the ultimate tippy top of this pyramid and the layers below it were the, oh, we're doing it for their sake, we're doing it for the planet's sake, you know, we're the balancing force in the universe that, you know, allows good to exist. I figured all of those were layers of people who were deceived also, but the dark controllers actually were trying to smash the whole thing and kill everybody, because a lot of people would say, well, if chemtrails are real, you know, why would they spray the air they breathe, you know, and stuff like this. I thought maybe they were actually suicidal nihilists that weren't possibly trying to smash the whole damn thing for the sake of, to their point of view, having all this technology, money, experience, wealth. To them, the only thing the Creator had on them at this point was creation itself. And they had got it in their inbred, incestuous, degenerative brains that they had thought their mission was to be the destroyer of all things, because they couldn't go back in time and create the whole thing. They had experienced everything known to man, so the only thing left in their toolbox, so to speak, would be to go ahead and destroy it all, and then they would be, you know, on par with the creator, like Shiva, and through the actions of destroying everything would, you know, force the cosmic forces out there to, you know, start something new. So by destroying everything here, they would be on the level with the creator, and in turn, you know, starting the seed of the next round of whatever happened. But, you know, that's twisted, and a lot of people can't go that far.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I think there's some truth in that, in part of what you said, in that, you know, we have the stories about the gods of the past, and there is no such thing as magic, only unlearned science. That's all there is. There is no such thing as magic. We saw people that had technology we didn't have, and because they knew things that we didn't, we gave them power over us. Because we thought they were more intelligent and that they should be the ones to decide. And then that's where the worship and all the false gods came in. So I think that there is a lot of truth to what you said in that they want power over creation. Because then they become the new gods.
Right.
We don't have it, they have it. And this goes right back to all of the PRS, problem, reaction, solution, right? They create the problem. We react the way they want us to, and then all of a sudden they have the solution, so we go back to the God syndrome again. So I think there's something to that in that respect, because they are using the laws of creation. They absolutely are. They know what they are. They can't do it any other way. They can't use harp unless they know. They can't create bioweapons unless they know. They can't do any of this unless they understand how it works. That's the precursor to taking all of the laws of creation and warping them or bending them in on themselves. So now that's your power. You have that power. And if you're the only one who has it, now you have that power over others. So, I think there's some truth to what you said. I don't know necessarily about the destruction part, although I do think that there are entities involved who I don't think are carnate, that they work with, that... Because I know this is really creepy, but there are entities that are denied this kind of existence, and they want it. They have wanted it for a very long time, and I'm sure you've met people who have that outlook, well, if we can't have it, nobody else can. And when people are not in a carnate state, they can see really far, really, really far. In terms of the future, and I think that these entities give them information and make them promises, but there's a whole other agenda behind it, that the people using this information to further their own agenda in terms of more money, more power, more land, more women, whatever, they eat it up, not really stopping to think about where is it all going in the end.
So where do you think it is going from that setup?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I personally do get kind of irritated when people say that there are aliens doing all of this, or it's the devil doing all of this, because, look, aliens didn't make CorExit, humans did. You know, we have to choose. And I think that a lot of that goes back to that story about in the Garden of Eden, the knowledge was misapplied. And I think that we always have a choice, but I think that people are used in a way that I think, there's a saying that sane people are not attracted to power. Right? It's only insane people that are attracted to power. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, because you can't get people who are sane to do those kinds of things. And so it shouldn't really surprise us when we look around and we know that all of the world leaders they're insane. I mean, they are. They're pedophiles. They've never lived a normal life. They don't know what it's like to actually work for a living. They've had nannies. They've had special schooling. It's like Paris Hilton you know, living with this poor family, and they said they had to go to Walmart, and she said, oh, do they sell walls there?
Right.
You know, I mean, they have no idea what reality is because they don't live in it. So all I can tell you is that regardless of who's behind it, I mean, you get to a point where you just have to move past it, because it doesn't matter who's ultimately behind it, because it's people that do it. So it doesn't matter whose idea it was. You know, it just doesn't matter, because we're the ones that actually have to implement it. We're the ones that have to do it. And I think that that's really the most important thing for people to understand, and that ignorance is key to all of this, because most people are not insane. Most people do care about their fellow man and their planet and the animals and all living things. And if they really understood what all of this was, what the laws of creation were and how they work, if they really had all of that information, none of this would be happening, because there are more of us, more sane people, than there are insane people. And, you know, there was an interesting story I watched once on YouTube, and I think it was actually Lorraine Moret, who's been talking a lot about the nuclear radiation in Fukushima. Are you familiar with her?
Yes.
This was a story I saw on YouTube a long time ago, but I think before she was doing this, she was working with a researcher that worked with monkeys. And she was an assistant for a few years, and she was telling this story about how they had been observing this particular clan of monkeys in the wild. And there was a female born that, when she had her own young, was very mean and didn't take care of the child. And all of the other mothers in this clan or tribe, they rejected her because of it. They ousted her. And this was her response. Now, I know this is animals, but I tell you, it makes a lot of sense if you look at the world today. This mother became enraged that they did this, and she would go around banging pots and pans and making a lot of noise and terrorizing all of the other monkeys in this clan, and in doing so, she became the alpha female. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right.
It's the same thing with humans. I mean, but there is something else going on now that I think people have to take into consideration. And I'm sure you went through it. I know I went through it. When you realize that your whole life you've been told what to do, you've been told that you're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to go to school, and then you're supposed to go to college, and you're supposed to drive this kind of car and live in this kind of house and marry this kind of person and have this kind of job and watch this kind of a news station and go to this kind of a doctor. But when you realize that most of it's garbage and that you have power, it very much reminds me of that scene in The Matrix where after they freed Neo, he's laying on the table and he opens his eyes for the first time and he says, "Why do my eyes hurt?" And they say, "Because you've never used them before." And free will is very much like that. Once you realize that you've never actually used it, it can be a scary thing to do it. Because your whole life, everybody in authority has told you what's right. And so if something went wrong, you could say, "Oh, well, it was his fault. He said so, right? Or it was her fault. She messed it up because she told me what to do." But so there's a paradox. There's a very real paradox in actually claiming your power, because your power is your will. It's your free will. That's what it is. To just absolutely throw it out there and simplify it, our personal power is our free will. We just have, and that's the other thing. This is very much a free will war. Because people don't make choices they don't know they have. So people think they're using free will. Well, gee, do I use gas or do I use ethanol or electrical cars? Well, you and I both know we shouldn't be using any of them.
Right.
But people don't choose something they don't understand. It is a choice. So that's been a very problematic thing for people that are trying to implement all the stuff that they're trying to implement, because we're realizing we have other choices. The cat's kind of out of the bag, and there's no way to put it back in.
Right, yeah, I hear the meowing all the time, and it's getting louder and louder in some respects.
It is. So I don't think that when they saw this whole Armageddon script, I don't think they realized that this was going to happen. And I think it's throwing a real kink into their whole, you know, into the whole theater they've got going on right now, because there are actors showing up that they didn't hire, and there are other actors that are saying lines that they weren't told to say because they realize they have another choice.
Right.
So it's messing up their whole production. But you know, that's the other part of it. And you and I, and I know many, many people that will listen to this get really frustrated and upset because they know that people they love don't realize they have other choices. And so they're still not using free will because the choices have been narrowed to the degree that there really isn't any. It's kind of like Republican or Democrat. Well, it doesn't matter. They're, you know, it's just two wings on the same bird. It can only fly if they work together, so it doesn't matter. So yeah, we do get frustrated, but I learned early on after I wrote the book, I actually had quite a few people email me and say they put off listening to my interviews because they weren't ready. Because it's a big, big deal to be in charge of yourself. It really is. Free will is a beautiful thing, especially when you realize you actually have it. But then you're confronted with using it. And what does that mean? Because if you mess up this time, who do you get to blame?
Yeah, it's that three fingers pointing back at you scenario.
Yeah. Right, right. But, you know, that's the thing. I mean, that's why I think the sacred science is so helpful, because it makes it really hard to mess it up. You know, if you understand how it works, you're already 10 steps ahead of everyone else, because people can't make stuff up, because it's really kind of strange, you know, like we were talking about with the Osama bin Laden kind of thing. They've had how many years to get really good at making stuff up?
Right.
and that's what they're coming up with now? I mean, that doesn't even make sense. It's like, it's almost like all the really good people, like all the really good liars they had quit all of a sudden, and now they're recruiting right out of high school or something. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. But, yeah, so people do have to be ready. But when they're ready, they'll find what they need the same way we all did.
And just on the off chance, since this is our second official chat, on the off chance somebody is tuning in for the first time, why don't you give a mini recap for somebody who is stubborn enough not to go listen to the first interview on your book and the sacred science? And obviously it's a huge topic, but the laws of creation, kind of a boil down of what all that would mean.
Oh, sure. Well, really, I was living just like everybody else. All the people that we love that we think, wow, I wish they would get it. I was one of those people who didn't get it. And this was in the year 2000, and a friend that I worked with who was very psychic wanted me to go see a psychic with her. I didn't particularly want to go because I was working 80 hours a week and I had taken an extra day off to spend with my family. But I thought, okay, it's a half an hour session. It's a half an hour drive there and back. It's an hour and a half out of my day, not a big deal. So she booked our sessions back to back. I drove across town. I was in this session with this woman. It actually lasted for an hour and a half. And she was telling me just some really, really, really far out, amazing, mind-blowing things, and she gave me my future 6 years in advance, which at the time I didn't realize, and one of the first things that she said to me was, you're not supposed to be doing what you're doing, you're supposed to be a writer and a healer. I really liked the woman, we hit it off well, but it was way too far out there for me at the time. I liked my life the way it was, the way a lot of people do right now. Don't fix it if it isn't broke, right?
Right.
That's where I was at. It wasn't broken, and I liked it. And I left, and within a year, every single part of my life began to break down. It was just, it was all turned completely upside down. I mean, pick something, you name it. I mean, financially, my family went bankrupt. A series of events occurred where I couldn't get back into the corporate world. We lost everything we had, you know, and what was so hard about that was really the first moment that I was forced to face that not only was I the kind of person who associated what I did for a living with my real identity as a human being, but so did everyone else. And all of the respect I had for the position that I held and the money that I made was gone, along with the money. And that was a very, very hard thing, because you're already feeling bad about yourself because your identity was what you did for a living. And now it's gone. And now everybody else is treating you differently. I mean, there's not a single friend I had from back then that I still have today. Not a one, because my life changed so dramatically. And basically what happened was everything that was artificial in my life was completely stripped in a very short period of time. And all I was left with was what this woman had said to me. And over the course of 6 years, everything that she said would happen, happened. And none of what she said to me actually was about going through this. It was just other stuff in my life, you know. So I'm sitting here. My old life is gone. I have no idea what I'm going to do. And I remembered that moment where she said, "This is, you're supposed to be writing. You're supposed to be a writer and a healer." So I thought, okay, I'll try it. So I started reading lots and lots of books because I realized that everything was connected somehow. I just wasn't sure how, and I thought, well, I'll see if I can kind of eke it out through these books and write a book about that. But something was missing. I just felt like something was missing because it, you know, you don't want to just write a book because somebody said you're supposed to. You want it to be meaningful. You know, you want it to have a purpose beyond that. You know, you want to help people. So then I got to a place where I started meditating and praying and basically literally on my knees saying, help me. What is it that I'm supposed to write about? If this is really what I'm supposed to do, if this is really my purpose in life, give me some direction because I really don't know. And when I started doing that, I started going through a phase, it lasted for about a year, where I started having information downloaded to me in my dreams. And I really don't know any other word to use for it. It wasn't like you're having a conversation with someone. It was just concepts. And sometimes it was images, like geometric shapes. It's kind of like, well, you know that saying, a picture is worth a thousand words?
Yep.
So we use the letter A, and all, it just makes a sound, A or A, that's it. But if you look at a hieroglyphic, it's a picture. It has all of this meaning and all of this stuff going on. It has a lot more information. And so that's what I mean by concepts. They were concepts that just had so much information that, and it was so different. It was really a lot to process because I just basically walked in off the street. You know, I didn't have parents that were teaching me anything spiritual. I didn't have any spiritual friends in terms of anything metaphysical. No family members. I didn't know a single other person on the planet who knew anything about this stuff. And what started to happen is, after about a year, I realized that they were trying to teach me the laws of creation. That's what they were trying to teach me. And I had come across it many, many times in books that I had. And in antiquity, it was called the One Law. And even though I had read all these books, it's just knowledge. It's just information. You know, it doesn't mean anything unless you have the other half. You know, you have to have the other part to it. And that's what I got in my dreams. And then I understood it. And I thought, oh, wow. It opened my eyes to everything that's happening. It showed me everything that was wrong. It showed me everything that we could be doing right. It showed me the proper path to our evolution. It showed me how things are created. It was pretty pretty damn cool. I have to be honest. It was really the coolest thing that ever happened to me in my life. It was, you know, way better than, you know, what I was doing before. That's for sure. It was neat. It really was.
And when they say the one law, that kind of infers there's only one. But the laws of creation or the tie-in to all this. What's a good way to boil that down for somebody who kind of sees it abstractly?
Well, there's so many ways to explain it. Really, it's hard, but basically the reason it was referred to as the one law is because it was understood that everything comes from this one source that's conscious. It's a conscious creator that produces all of these laws that are the pattern that creation follows. And if you understand the pattern and you understand how all of these patterns co-create all of the other patterns, then you know whether or not what you're doing is in line with these patterns, or is it creating a different pattern? Is it taking the pattern and changing it into something else? And that's important because all of these patterns create, regenerate, and uphold life. That's what they do. So if you change one, you start changing the patterns that create life, and when you do that, you begin to experience degeneration, disintegration, and death, and disease, and those kinds of things. So it also helps you understand, you know, a lot of people get made fun of because people can't understand the science that they're using, and it really is a science, but even though it was called the One Law, I prefer to call it the sacred science because I want people to understand that everything that we call science has a sacred purpose. And when we take the sacred out of the equation, we get HARP and we get bioweapons and we get fluoride in the water and we get genocide and we get all this other stuff going on because we don't remember the original purpose for it anymore. But a really good example of how it works, just one of the ways it works, because, I mean, there are probably millions of these laws. But the principles that they're based on help us understand how they function. And a really good example is Masaru Emoto's work. A lot of people are familiar with that. He, through these beautiful pictures of water crystals, he could show you an image of how the consciousness of a human being in terms of their thoughts and their words would create a pattern that then went into the water, and then the water would form a crystal that reflected the pattern back so that we could see, we could actually see what these patterns do. And in that sense, I refer to it in the book as programming an element. In this case, it's water. And it can be done with music, it can be done with thoughts, it can be done with intentions, it can be done with words. But when you understand how that part of it works, then you can understand sciences that people don't pay attention to, like homeopathy. Now, a lot of people think that homeopathy is junk science because what they will often do, and again, it should be understood that people, this science comes from a source in the past that understood this sacred science, because otherwise you would never do it, because you wouldn't understand that it works. But basically what they do is, as an example, there's a guy in New York, I can't remember his name, he's a doctor out there, but he was treating autism children with scorpion venom. And the way he would do it is he would put scorpion venom in water, and then he would dilute the water and dilute the water and dilute the water until there was no trace of the venom left. And then he would give the water to the patient. Now, if you tried to tell somebody today that that works without understanding the sacred science, of course, they would think that you were a lunatic. They would have absolutely no idea why does that work. And the reason that it works is because water has memory, which is part of that's another part of what Masaru Emoto showed, is that water is programmable in the sense that it has a memory. So in homeopathy, it's not what you're adding to the water that makes it work. It's actually what you take out of it, because water remembers what it was programmed with. And the reason that I think this doctor was using scorpion venom is because It goes back to frequency. If you understand the frequency of what it is you're trying to draw out, that's the frequency of what you're putting in the water. Because what happens is, because water remembers, it will try to seek out what you stripped it of, and it will cleanse the body of it. Do you know what I'm saying? It will leach it out. So, for example, you have to be careful if you use distilled water, because it doesn't have any more minerals in it.
Right.
So, but it did have minerals in it before it was distilled, and it remembers that it had these minerals. So when you drink the water, it will leach those minerals from your body to replace what it lost. But in this, so that's, you know, and that's, again, you have to understand how it works, because you can misapply it. You can misuse it, you know, in a way that's detrimental. So you have to really understand the principles behind it. But in the case of the scorpion venom, that was what it was used for, to draw out anything in the body that had this frequency that was harmful, to leach it out and purify the system. So people say, oh, no, no, it's junk science, but it's not. It actually works. You just have to understand why. And if I didn't personally understand the sacred science, I still would have thought it was junk science, because I couldn't understand how it was working.
Right. So the water was programmed with, you know, a general toxin that was, you know, natural, for lack of a better word, and then through the dilution process, it was, the water memory was stripped of this natural toxin. So as the dilution process continued, it had more and more of a yearning to put that toxin back in, and then when the patient drank it, you know, it's basically leaching out all the toxins in that system, looking for the scorpion venom, and in that process, healing or detoxifying the autistic patient.
Right, and again, it's not trying to leach out scorpion venom per se. It's trying to leach out something that has the same frequency. Because some frequencies are good for us, and some frequencies are bad for us. So frequency is a big, big, big part of it too. So you kind of have to know what is the frequency of the thing that you're trying to draw out. But of course, you know, you could use anything really. I mean, if you were trying to purify the body of mercury, you could do the same thing, and again use the same process to draw it out. So, and that's one way. And then, of course, there's alchemy. Everything is so connected to everything else. Now, because of this resonance, I don't know if I talked to you about this, but one of the things that really struck me about the earthquake in Japan is that the planetary, it's not an alignment per se, but the placement of the planets at the time were very important to Japan. Because Japan's ruling planet is Uranus. And what a lot of people don't know is that Uranus governs uranium and Pluto governs plutonium. So these planets being in the alignment that they were at the time was part of what happened to Japan. And it took the individuals using this technology to know that alignment would happen when it did, to create the kind of situation that they did. Because these things resonate with each other, and people may say, well, that's ridiculous. But, I mean, ask yourself, how did science come to name uranium, if they didn't realize that the planet Uranus actually has the same kind of frequency and can amplify it? So that's part of the alchemy part of it. Now, when you understand how it works, then you can start to ask some really important questions, like, for instance, when they really push vaccinations, for example, and we know that these vaccines have mercury in them, are they doing it under planetary alignments where mercury is in a position that will make the mercury more harmful, will amplify it in the body? I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me, and I can tell you that the people at the very tippy top of this pyramid everybody talks about, they know what you and I are talking about. They understand how this works. The people that they dictate the orders to may have absolutely no idea. But as soon as people begin to understand how it works, then they can look around and ask some really important questions. Because, again, if we know how it works, we know if it's being used against us. Because we will understand what they understand.
So as we, the good guys, so to speak, move through this, is finding, like when you're trying to match these frequencies, is knowing the frequency beforehand important, or much like octaves work, you know, I'm sure the relationship between uranium and Uranus would be a factor of something. It would be the same frequency, different octave, if we knew the specific frequency of each. Because, well, with things like planets, you can, you know, they emit a sound or a frequency itself.
Well, that's exactly right, Jacob, and that is the truth, one of the many deep, deep truths behind as above, so below. For everything that's above on the larger scale, it has a counterpart on the lower scale, because it's always the same technology, only the scale changes. That's what that means, as above, so below. So, yeah, at some point, yes, civilian science should understand all of this, and really just to go a little bit deeper so that people can, if they're still struggling with it, I want to assure them that the military knows this, and I'll give you a very poignant example. And it can be found in Dr. Nick Begich's book, Angels Don't Play This Harp. But he's talking about cyclotronic resonance. And the military found the frequency for lithium in the human body. It's naturally occurring, but for some people who may have some kind of psychological disorder attributed to a chemical imbalance in the brain, they'll be given doses of lithium as medication. But in this particular case, what the military did is, because they understood the frequency of lithium, they could aim a beam at the body with the same frequency and amplify it as though the individual was given a massive dose without the individual ever having to take the drug externally. That's a form of alchemy. That's what we're talking
right
about. So, but it's been weaponized. I think that's really one of the most important things to try to explain to people, is that all of this ignorance and all of this dumbing down was done so that we wouldn't know, because if you and I knew, we would know that they were doing it to us. We would have the same knowledge. So it's very real, very, very real knowledge. It's just being weaponized and abused. But the really concerning part to me about that is not just that it's cruel, but that you're talking about taking the laws of creation and perverting them and twisting them and bending them, and in some cases you can actually break them, and if you break them, they don't function anymore. So, you know, the planet has the law of weather. Weather is driven by other laws, and when we have weather wars happening, we're taking those laws and we're weaponizing them. We are not allowing them to do what they are designed to do naturally. And the problem with that is that every law co-creates all of the other laws. So as soon as you change one, you've immediately changed the others. I mean, if you could think of it like a spider web, and in the center ring, you just change the center. But because the center shoots off, it has these straight webs that shoot off into all these different directions that are connected to all of these different rings. I mean, I personally don't believe that there is a supercomputer on this planet now, or I'm not even sure that there ever will be, that can understand all of the effects of doing that, because everything co-creates everything else. So if you start changing the weather, everything that depended on that in the inner circle, the next outer circle is affected by it. And then everything that depended on that circle is affected by it. And it's like this huge ripple that goes out. So it's not a good thing that we have a bunch of psychopaths trying to restructure reality so that they can weaponize it.
Right. And anybody familiar with my website knows I've been on the directed energy topic, whether it's 9/11 or John Hutchison or Tesla. you know, all of these things. They talk about also interfering separate frequencies. And I used to play the trumpet, so I've got a good idea of how this can work on the smaller scale. When you try and tune two trumpets, even if they're both playing the same note, so to speak, if one of them is out of tune, you can hear the beats in between. They are in disharmony, so you can hear it. And then if you tune the out of tune trumpet to the proper resonance with the other, then it's a clean sound. So when people talk about, you know, like John Hutchison uses multiple frequencies, whether it's a static frequency and then like a radio frequency, he can achieve things like levitation and, you know, movement, you know, particle dissociation. Is this?
Well, right, and that's an important phrase that you just used, particle dissociation, right? Because now people can understand why so many people would build free energy devices and then have it confiscated and be told that it was confiscated because they just built a weapon of mass destruction. Because you can use the technology both ways. And if this is completely new to people, I really highly recommend going back and listening to the other shows that I've done, because I try and every show to use different examples of it, because there are so many different ways that you can use it. And one of those is you know, the Rice machine. There's positive offset frequencies. There's just so many, many ways that you can use it for healing and life, because that's what the original intent was for. So we can undo a lot of this. I mean, I know that people are just horrified, you know, at what's happening to the planet, again, by people who think they're going to get the credit for our enlightenment for having done it. But we can fix it. We can undo it if we understand all of this and if there is enough of us. That's the other thing. So it's really important that, you know, we try to move past all the boundaries that divide people. You know, I'm tall and you're short, so we're enemies. Or, you know, my grandmother hated your grandmother, so we're enemies. Or, you know, whatever. We live on the same planet. So if my planet dies, your planet dies. You know, can we at least agree on that and maybe go from there?
Because in John Hutchison's early days, he was, you know, basically, you know, screwing around, you know, and trying to figure out what did what. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, because he wasn't, you know, working from a playbook. He was just understood that, you know, interfering these frequencies, you know, had different effects here and there. And I would hope as people understand this and move forward in that, you know, we could, let's say, to oversimplify it, write some of these down so the next time it's not, you know, somebody playing around. And we could understand quickly what frequencies, you know, heal and what frequencies dissociate. Because there's, like you said, this can be used either way. The Hutchison effect, as a lot of people call it, you know, can clean up water in the Gulf, or it can, you know, dustify skyscrapers. So,
yeah, you know, I came across a totally awesome, awesome interview that Red Ice did. It's still up if people want to go look at it, with a fellow called Ralph Ring on ether technology, Tesla, and magnetism, and a fellow named Otis Carr. Absolutely, absolutely fascinating, fascinating stuff, because they understood this. And what is so fascinating to me is that they understood it the way the ancients understood it, which is not that we're just dealing with an energy source. We're dealing with what some people call the source of everything. And it's alive, and it's everywhere. It's in us, it's around us, we're part of it, it's in everything, but it's literally alive, it's living. And the ancients referred to this as the creator, or in some cases the law, or the creator of the law, because they understood that in order for all of these laws to exist, in perfection, in perfect harmony, there had to be intention. And then, of course, if there's intention, there's consciousness. So it's a fantastic interview. I highly recommend it. It's Because it's not, because again, it's important that we don't just look at this as technology. It's sacred. It really is sacred. There's a sacred half to it. And if we don't include that sacred half, we misapply the knowledge. So it's really important that we bridge that gap between the, you know, if you want to call it science and religion, fine. If you want to call it the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, or you know, love and science, you know, however you want to look at it, we really have to bridge that gap, because we are not going to evolve the way that we were meant to if we don't.
Right, and that that interview is on my playlist, so I'm really excited now. But I haven't heard it yet. But that's, you know, one of the pieces that keeps me going is that regardless of the tippy top of the pyramid, there is ultimately one source. And whether the, you know, dark controllers are able to finish the planet off or not, I sleep better at night knowing that, for lack of a better word, they're also a creation of the one source. So there's something cosmic to it, and not that it's.
That's true, but that doesn't mean they have to behave
right.
Like it.
Or
you see, that's where free will comes in.
And here's the other thing, that what you were talking about earlier with reclaiming our power, if this force is you know, not of body or in another realm, dimension, spirit, what have you, they're deriving their earthly power from us. So ultimately, as wicked and evil and as brutal as they are, we are required for their existence, if that makes any sense. Since they can't incarnate here, they have some type of influence. But just like, you know, the bad kid at school with the ideas of breaking into 7-Eleven, you know, there's influence or what have you, but that doesn't mean we have to go along with it. You know, you can be promised, you know, all of the women, money, and illicit substances on the planet. And if that's their carrot, let's say, that they're dangling, you know, it still requires our movement and our manifestation for, you know, their ultimate evil ends or what have you.
Well, it absolutely does, in terms of their reward they think they're going to get in the here and now, which is based on a system of money. All of the control comes through money. And all of the systems that are set up are designed to keep feeding them more of it. It takes more away from us and gives more of the money to them. So it's built on a false structure, but it's the one that most people have accepted. So that's really important, because if money wasn't part of the equation, what power would they have over us?
Very little. It's like the egregore or the tulpa or the homunculus. You know, these things are alchemical or magical creations that live in the minds of the people that believe in them. You know, and if it's powerful enough or a good enough, you know, egregore, you know, the story goes that it can physically manifest, but that just is another small example. And I've heard Tracy Twyman, another researcher, you know, put money in that category, that it is the magic trick, that the whole entire value system and lust and greed and everything that goes with it is all a product of our imagination. I mean, there's a little piece of paper there that represents that, but the rest of the story, so to speak, you know, just lives in our minds.
Well, it's artificial. I mean, that's really all a person needs to understand is it's artificial. Can you and I breathe artificial air? I mean, you know, can we get it from artificial trees? Are we supposed to eat artificial food? It's all becoming artificial. It's all bypassing the natural system that gives us life. And every time we do that, life starts to break down. And there's a reason money doesn't grow on trees. It's artificial. You can't eat it. You can't breathe it. You can't drink it. The fish can't eat it. You know, the sun doesn't need it, plants don't need it, water doesn't need it, it's completely artificial. It bypasses the entire natural system, and what it does is it allows people to then buy that system that is natural and decide who they want to sell it back to and for what price. That's where the whole slavery dynamic comes in, is trying to own nature. And you can only own nature if you use money. Because then you turn around and buy and sell it, right? I mean, I'm sure you've heard they're already patenting genes. So pretty soon they're going to own some of the genes in our body. I mean, really? You know, they're buying up all the aquifers. The water barons are moving to money because they want to start buying and selling water more for more than it is now. That's going to be the new oil pretty soon, especially if they keep contaminating the water. So, and a lot of people help these people because they're greedy, beyond belief greedy. So, they make more money. I mean, it's kind of like boots and coots, right? Buying that oil cleanup company before the spill happened, they made a lot of money off of that. So there are people that are making an awful lot of money off of not just the demise of other people, but of the planet, which is another form of insanity, because if there's no more people left on the planet, what are you going to do with money?
Or I've often thought, once all the land is, you know, quote unquote, bought, you know, then what? Do we start selling, you know, ocean seafloors? Or it's absurd at either extreme, and so should it be in the middle. And that's why it's almost humorous once you see it that people don't get it yet. But you're talking about, I call him Mr. Emoto. I can't ever pronounce his first name properly. With his water experiment, but he's kind of famous for another thing, the rice experiment that people may be familiar with. Why don't you give a little thumbnail sketch of that? Because that's another piece of his work that I find translates rather well with all of this.